Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I am going to be your host. So today, we are talking with Chris Tate from The Trading Game. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Kirk. And yourself?
I'm doing great. Doing great. So, Chris, tell us a little bit about your background.
Okay. In sort of the 50 words or less sort of description you need for these sort of things, I'm a professional trader down here in Australia. And my background is somewhat unusual because I actually have no background in finance. My academic background is, or was, many, many, many years ago, the study of the human immune system. So I'm perhaps the poster child for the notion that to be successful in this sort of investing / trading world, you don't actually need to have a firm background within this world. And I've currently come out of retirement a few decades ago to co-found a business called The Trading Game.
You mentioned that you're from a different industry. And of course, I'm sure that listeners are thinking, like, when's he going to ask him about COVID? Well, we're not going to do that, I hope. But
thank God.
I do want to point out, though, that what I find is some of the more successful people in trading tend to come from different backgrounds, you know, from the medical field, your background's the immune system. There's, you know, engineers, but, you know, people with other backgrounds, I find it's people who have a really strong ability to think.
You've used that power word, think. And I think it's that ability to process information in an independent way. I was having a discussion with someone yesterday, and they were saying that the problem they faced when they left university having done finance was that there is academic finance and then there is real-world finance. And they had real trouble marrying the two up because what their professors said should happen very, very rarely actually happened. And so they had to reorient the way they thought to become more of a problem solver and less of an applier of theories they'd picked up along the way.
A few of my friends have worked at some of the bigger name firms, some of the top firms that everyone's probably heard of. And when they get hired, they come in and say, we're really glad that you guys are all smart. Everyone here is smart. You can throw everything you learned out the window. Really, what's important is the experience on the floor. So in some of the firms, they'll give them kind of a small trading account and get them started just so they can get the experience. Because it's not academic at all, as you said. So how did you learn when you started? Like, how did you kind of go about learning to be a trader?
I was in some ways fortunate in that I began my interest in markets during the 1980s bull market. And I'd been involved because of the work I was doing with a few biotech startups. I knew some people in the industry and the interest grew from there. So I actually started trading my own account. I made the classic mistake that everybody makes in a bull market. They think they're a genius. I didn't realize, it hadn't dawned on me, that all boats float on a rising tide. So it was nothing special I was doing. And then the 87 crash came along. And I thought, well, I probably should get some sort of formal education in this. And I thought, who knows about trading? Well, stockbrokers do. That was my second mistake. And I managed to talk my way into a stockbroking firm here locally. I got in simply on the fact that I had a calculator, the old Hewlett-Packard 12C, has no equals button, which confuses people no end. And they were fascinated by that. They thought it was a piece of black magic. And because derivatives were becoming a thing and I have a quantitative background, I managed somehow to sneak my way in through the door. And that's how I got my formal start in the business. And it was very much learn on the job and learn with your own money, which whilst an effective way to learn is a little bit difficult because you have to bank on the fact that you survive long enough to learn enough to survive a little bit longer. And if you run out of money, your education tends to come to a screeching halt.
I think that's a really important topic. You know, you're getting into the topic of risk management and, you know, it's like going to the casino. Like, when do you leave? Well, most people leave when they run out of money, right?
Oh, very much. It's that revolving door. in comes a new punter and out goes a older, slightly poorer punter. And it doesn't matter how you approach markets or investing or whatever. The number one rule, and this is a point I agree with Warren Buffett on, where he says that rule one is don't lose money. And rule two is refer to rule one again. Because when the money runs out, the game ends.
I've heard from a lot of people that survival is a big part of it. Being able to survive long enough to get good at it, to survive long enough so that you don't lose and then you have to go get a real job. I mean, there's lots of part of trading. And I want you to kind of maybe from a high level, like what are some of the more important things that people need to consider if they want to do this professionally?
Traders seem to go through an evolution, or traders slash investors. And I use the word interchangeably. And the evolution is that they approach markets thinking that there is something magical they need to learn, whether it be a form of analysis, a computer program they need, something external to them. Now, if you survive long enough, you actually realize that most of investing is an internal endeavor, and it's based upon your own behaviors. So, and this is why you get investors slash traders with a wide range of techniques, but they're all successful. It's not the technique. It's the way they're applying it and the way they think and manage themselves. And it comes back to what you said about risk management. The best risk managers in the world are also the best at controlling themselves. And that's the central issue, is that capacity to control yourself so that you can apply your methodology, so that you can manage risk, so that all the emotions that go on in the market, you're insulated from. And one of the things that's intrigued me over, well, let's say the past decade, is the rise of sort of investing on courtesy of social media, particularly Twitter. What's wonderfully intriguing about the people on Twitter is that you'll get people who will appear and who for a week or a month will boast completely about what they're doing. They'll tell everybody how much of a genius they are, and then they disappear. And you know exactly what's happened. Their ego has gotten in front of their ability and they've blown up. And they'll disappear for 6 months, come back, have a small winning streak, boast about that again, and then repeat the cycle. And all they're doing is repeating the cycle of letting their ego run them over. That's the central point. So traders start very mechanically. They read all the books, they get all the computer programs, they subscribe to all the services. And if they survive long enough, they actually start to realize that it's not that those things are irrelevant. It's the actual application of them. And we've all seen this. You may see athletes who are wonderful performers in practice, wonderful performers in heats. They might be very good at regional comps, state comps, but they get to nationals and something goes wrong. And what goes wrong is they don't suddenly lose their ability. It's that they've lost the capacity to manage their emotions at that point, which is why very, very high-level athletes all have some form of psychologist slash mental health wellness coach of some degree or prescription.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And actually, it brings up something that I had read recently, which was talking about athletes where, you know, you look at fear, right? You think about people who have fear about certain topics, whatever it might be. Maybe it's losing money. Maybe it's, you know, mountain climbing, whatever it is. But the way they described it, they said with athletes, they actually they're able to transform fear into anxiety. So it's still fear, but they don't see it as fear. They see it as being anxious, like anxious about the big game. And to me, I never thought of that. I mean, I was an athlete and I never thought of it that way. But yeah, I was never afraid of a game, but definitely the anxiety. And it's almost like you kind of look forward to that at some stage.
I think that's a very valuable point, simply because there is a dividing line between anxiety and fear. Fear is debilitating, whereas anxiety can be energizing. If you look at the sort of physiological pathway of anxiety, anxiety is actually priming the body for action. Now, granted, some of those symptoms are unpleasant. You know, that hollowness you feel in your stomach, that nervousness before an event or a game, they're unpleasant, but they're not debilitating. Fear will actually cause people to completely lock up. Anxiety causes people to prime themselves, to become more aware, to switch on, if you want to use that term.
One thing that kind of comes to mind from something you just said also is you'd mentioned people understanding their own psychology. And that's something that I talk about a lot in this show is there really are no right or wrong ways to invest. Well, I think we can argue there are probably some wrong ways to invest. But if you look at all the different successful ways to invest, they're really not good or bad. They're just maybe good or bad for certain people. I'll give you an example, which you can probably appreciate. So a bunch of years ago, I was mainly focused on individual stocks, equities. And I think it was 2010, the markets are going up or down 10%, I think like 20 some odd times that year. And people just kept getting stopped out. And you end up being down because you kept getting stopped out until I realized like that is not one of my strengths. Like stop losses are not one of my strengths. And so I came up with another way to handle it, which is using options, which addresses it in a different way. But it basically takes that psychological weakness of dealing with that and finds another way to solve the problem. And so for me, using options was a much better way to handle the problem than through individual equities, which, you know, we still do. But in solving that particular problem, that was a way that I solved with my own psychology because I know that was my weakness. So going into it, it was not a good idea to do something that I know is going to be a psychological problem for me.
That's the self-awareness of being able to find your game and play your game. I think what happens with a lot of people who come to markets is that they don't have that capacity. They think there is only one way, and that one way might not be their way. It's a little bit like the analogy I use when I'm teaching people in that we don't give people a black box. We say to people, okay, what do you want to do? And let's try and work out how you can integrate that into your aims, your ambitions, your lifestyle, your background. And the analogy I use when people question as to why they can't just be given the way I do things is quite simple. I have size 13 feet. I have clown feet. Do you have clown feet, yes or no? And the answer is generally no. And my response to that is, well, then you can't wear my shoes. You can try, but it will be immensely uncomfortable for you. One of the things I've noticed among successful people, it doesn't matter what field, is that they've managed to find what their game is and they play their game and they're not distracted by other people's games or what other people do. And I think this is the great failing of things like social media, in that people see the way other people do things and they think, well, I should be doing as well. My questioning of that is really quite simple. It is, how do you know they're doing that well? Because I've had people pop up on my Twitter feed saying that they're making 1,000% per month. And my response to that is, well, let's assume you started with $1,000 and we'll do that for a year. You're now the richest person on the planet. Is that sensible, yes or no? And I have people pop up, particularly on my LinkedIn page, with their supposed, you know, trading schemes that have a linear equity curve. That is, their equity curve, when you look at it, graph, starts at the bottom left and goes straight up to the top right with no bumps or hiccups or dips. Then they put the results up and they say, well, the maximum number of trades I got wrong in a row was one. And I think, really, okay, that to my way of thinking is just illogical and doesn't make sense. But someone will think it does.
I love those games when people do that. I think Bernie Madoff did that too.
He seemed to have done it exceptionally well for a very long period of time.
Yeah. No, one thing that kind of comes to mind is you're saying that we talk about this a lot. Like everyone wants to invest like Warren Buffett, but for some reason there's only one Warren Buffett. You got to think, why is that? There are plenty of successful, really bright people out there that try to mimic him, and yet they still can't get the returns that Warren Buffett gets. You know, when you think about how you want to invest, I love the fact you're saying like you have to invest your own way. You can't invest in how other people invest.
It's a little bit like if you coach junior basketball, everybody wants to be LeBron James. And you think, well, that's a wonderful aspiration. But to date, there does only seem to be one. That spot seems to be taken. And I don't think they're advertising for that spot at present. It's very difficult to get young athletes to play their own game. It's good to be aspirational and the rest. But sooner or later, you've got to realize that you are going to max out at a 6'1" tall white guy. So playing like LeBron James is probably not in your future. You have to find your own way of doing it.
I heard a podcast recently that was interviewing a celebrity. I'm drawing a blank on the guy's name, but he was talking about how in comedy, because he was a comedian, he was talking about in comedy how when people start comedy, they tend to imitate other comedians. And comedians tend to be pretty territorial about their stuff.
Yes.
You know, if you're stealing their stuff, they're not going to be happy about
annoyed.
It. Yeah. But, you know, when you're starting in comedy, and actually I think this probably applies to just about anything, is when you're starting out, imitation is a natural first step. But as you kind of come into your own, you need to really make it yours, because otherwise everybody would be doing things the same way.
As a teacher, you have to give people freedom to find their own form of expression. One of the things that used to really irk me when I was teaching in academia is that many people simply wanted clones of themselves, as opposed to someone who brought something unique to the field and something unique in the way of seeing the world. Academia is very territorial. In many ways, it is like finance. I met as many narcissistic sociopaths in academia as I did in finance. They want people to be like them without realizing that people have their own way of solving problems. And just because it is a different mechanism, it doesn't mean it's the wrong mechanism. It's just a slightly different way. And people need to be given the freedom to find that expression. But unfortunately, in investing, you need to be able to survive long enough to find your mechanism of expression.
So what are some ways that people can figure out their own investor psychology?
That's an immensely powerful question. Part of it is actually doing it. That, unfortunately, is the difficulty with investing. Let's use a hobby I've had over the years as an example. When you take up the sport of kickboxing, one of the things that occurs is it's a gradual process of inoculation. You don't just suddenly jump into the ring in Thailand and start belting the living daylights out of one another. You learn how to hold your hands, how to stand. There's even steps before that where you learn how to wrap your hands, how to put your gloves on, how to move. You're even taught how to skip. And over time, there is this process of inoculation where you'll start off hitting the pads. Then you'll start off hitting the pads, and the pad person who feeds you the pads, that is the person who holds the pads, will tap you on the end of your gloves to prompt you to keep your hands up to strike in a certain way. And so over time, you're inoculated. The unfortunate thing about trading is there's no process of inoculation. Trading is a little bit like trying to learn to swim in the English Channel by swimming in the English Channel. It's very, very difficult as a first off. And the unfortunate thing is that many people bring a lot of the things they've learned or think they've learned about trading from external sources to the market. So you'll see things like they'll have concentration bets. That is, they'll have this notion that, well, to win big, you have to bet big because that's how casinos work. Well, have you noticed that in casinos, the people who make all the money is the casino, and they don't actually bet big to win big. They just take little chunks off you. That's their game. And it's convincing people that you can start small, that you can actually put your toe in the water, that you can take time to educate yourself. That educating yourself in and of itself as a mechanism is problematic, because the first thing people default to are the business channels on cable TV or newspapers or, heaven forbid, social media. And they're actually the worst places for people to educate themselves, simply because they're full of people who have their own biases, they're pushing their own barrow. Social media is largely false. Many of the things you read on it simply don't occur. That in and of itself is a problem. And the way we have found that people tend to do well, and this applies to any field, whether it be business, sport, academia, whatever, is to find a mentor, someone who can say, look, I made that mistake doing that. Don't do that. This is a mistake I made. This is how I solved it. And they act as a guide. My view, for example, of things like wealth management is that when it's personalized wealth managers act as guides in that what they try and do is say, well, here are mistakes we have observed. Let's try and avoid those mistakes for you, whilst at the same time taking into account who you are. And so it comes down to finding the right people to talk to. And again, that's a little bit problematic at times, and it does take time. But we come back to that notion of success in that success just takes time. And there are setbacks, there are pitfalls. Everybody has them. I've had them, you would have had them, everybody we know would have had them. It is just the way the world is set up. You hear people talk about being an overnight success after 10 years of hard work. And that's unfortunate about everything in life.
But let's talk about some like practical things that people can do, like paper trading or like, because you know, you have to start somewhere.
One of the good things about technology now is that a whole raft of firms offer demo accounts. And demo accounts are very, very good in that what they get you over is the hump of doing things like analysis, of placing orders, because the last thing you want to do is to go through all the hard work of, you know, learning about your methodology and doing all the background work that you're supposed to. But then all of a sudden you're confronted about, well, how do I actually place an order? I don't know how to do that. And so demo accounts help in that respect. The unfortunate thing about the demo account is that there's no skin in the game. And with there being no skin in the game, what happens is that emotional content of investing is missing. We're back to this notion about talking about psychology, and that if you have no skin in the game, there's no emotional content to what you're actually doing. And so when you do actually begin to trade, issue a little bit further ahead, but you still have that problem. My advice to people is always the same. Start as small as humanly possible. And exchanges and investment vehicles now allow this in that we have mini and micro contracts. Minimum dealing sizes disappeared a very long time ago when, you know, the technology changed about 20, 25 years ago. So start as small as humanly possible. And when you start as small as humanly possible, your risk is as small as you can get away with. Because your aim in these early sort of embryonic stages is not to make money. It's to minimize how much you actually lose. And so that my approach has always been to think of it as tuition. If you go to university, it costs. The aim is to get as much educational bang for buck as you can so that you get the lessons, but they don't come with an extraordinary financial cost. But it's also to understand that everybody goes through the same journey. You will make exactly the same mistakes as everybody else who has ever invested made. That's just the way it is. They'll be idiosyncratic because they're your mistakes, but they're not unique. And there is a difference in that. So start small, tiny risk, take advantage of the free tools on offer like demo accounts where you can actually begin to get practice. And the most important thing is that when you go live, keep a journal. Write down the rationale as to why you did things when you did them, but also note your emotions at the time, because that serves as a little library you can refer back to. It becomes an educational tool. One of the things that sort of irks me about people who start is that if they don't do that, each trade they do is unique in that it's starting afresh again. They don't have this capacity to look back and go, well, I did this that time and it didn't work, but I did this, so let's do that again. It must be the scientist in me looking for replication and data. And I think that is the key thing. If you understand why you did things, that is, you've written them down, you have a manual to guide yourself, and so your learning becomes self-directed. And self-directed learning is actually very powerful and very, very motivational for people.
What are some techniques people can do to take control or make sure they remain in control of their emotions? Because fear and greed are very powerful emotions. So how do you kind of tell people about that?
Fear and greed are immensely powerful, and they are the market drivers, and they're individual drivers and they're group drivers. The most important thing people can do, it sounds simple and it sounds silly, but every high performance person does it. They simply take a deep breath before they start and they pause. And it's interesting how this technique spans all fields. You watch a basketball player on the three throw line. They pause, they have a routine. There's a certain number of times they bounce the ball, they stand in a certain way, and then they shoot. They don't just walk up to the line and let rip. They stop and they pause. Tennis players do the same. They're immensely idiosyncratic before they serve. But what is interesting is that, and I was having this conversation many, many years ago with a neurosurgeon, and I said, how do you prepare for a big case? And he said, well, you go through the case in your head the night before, you go through the case in your head through breakfast. You step into the operating theatre, and before you start, I tell everybody to step back. Everybody steps back from the table, they pause, and then we begin. Because very rarely in life is there a situation, and certainly not in trading or investing, where you must do something right now. And if you don't do it, the world ends. And so it is that introduce the notion of a pause, just stop. Even as a wider sort of piece of advice for life, most people's lives would be much better if before opening their mouths, they just stopped. Most people's journey to work in traffic would be much more relaxed if before giving the bloke next to them a lecture about how poor their driving was, they just took a deep breath and they paused. The same is true in trading. Before you launch yourself at the market, just stop, just wait. Just introducing a pause tends to calm people down. It tends to slow the process down. And it's a technique. I worked my way through university as a doorman, as a bouncer. And one of the things I used to do was before I entered any form of confrontation was just to pause. And that pause calmed me down. And in calming me down, I could calm other people down. So if you can down-regulate your own anxiety, then your decisions become much clearer. Because when you're under stress, and this comes back to what you mentioned before, the dichotomy between fear and anxiety, is that if you can down-regulate your fear to anxiety, then you become primed to take action properly. You see things more clearly. You'll still be anxious, but you won't do something stupid because being fearful causes you to do something stupid.
You kind of alluded to something with what you were just saying where you said people feel like they need to do something. I see that a lot, and sometimes I feel that because I think it's a natural feeling like you have to do something. How do you advise people to handle that when people feel like they need to make a trade or they need to do this? Like, how do you advise people on that?
I'll probably take a step back. There's a very good book that I recommend that people read, and it's not trading related at all. And it's called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. And it was written by the Canadian astronaut, Chris Hadfield. And in it, he has a wonderful line. And he says, as an astronaut, there is no problem that you can't make worse. The same is true in investing. There is no problem you can't actually make worse. And you generally make things worse by your own interaction, by launching into the problem preemptively. And it comes back to this notion of if you have your manual, your journal, over time what that will evolve into is a set of key steps that you must do before you make an investment. Unfortunately, many people think that investing is you simply make things up as you go along. But as we both know, it's a carefully controlled process whereby you have effectively a flight plan that says, if this happens, I will look for this. If that happens, I will look for that. And when all these things coalesce, I will do this. And so having that checklist in place in many ways stops that compulsion. Now, it won't stop it completely because when you look at the rationale as to why people trade, the prime reason is entertainment. It sounds very, very strange, but the majority of people do not trade financial markets to be rich. They trade to be entertained. And by having a checklist, you curtail some of that entertainment value. It becomes mechanistic. And it doesn't matter whether you look at fundamental investors like Warren Buffett, he has a checklist. Or when you look at strictly quantitative investors like, say, Jim Simons, who runs Renaissance Technology, who is a very high-powered and high-level mathematician, he has a checklist. It's a different list but it's still a list. And it comes back to the point you made at the beginning. There are a variety of ways to play this game, and all ways are largely successful. It just depends on whether it's your way, your game, and whether you apply that technology, that methodology, in a consistent and coherent basis.
I love that point about the people look at it as entertainment. And I see that a lot. It's the kind of gambling mentality. And those of you who are watching financial media, I certainly don't, because I don't find much value there either. As a side note, the day that I stopped doing that was the day that the reporter interrupted Warren Buffett after asking him a question to answer the question himself as if we care about what the reporter thought. And he interrupted Warren Buffett. I was like, all right, I think it's time to stop watching this news station.
Yeah, I think we're done here, aren't we?
Yeah, but you know, when you talk about entertainment, you know, I see this a lot. People feel like they're gamblers, like they need the action. I guess this kind of segues into my next line of thinking is there are a lot of people who need action, and there's certain types of assets or investing or investment styles that are more geared towards action. How do you look at that? Because, you know, people like Warren Buffett do the exact opposite, and they're trying to push away from action as much as possible by living in Omaha, by steering clear of the financial, you know, industry. So how do you look at that?
That's a very powerful point. It's one of those take-home points in that you need to insulate yourself as much as possible from other people. I take the view that if the masses aren't doing one thing, if you do the opposite, then your chances of doing well go through the roof, because the majority of people get it wrong. All markets and all financial arenas seem to go through a cycle. And here in Australia several years ago, it was the cycle of, to be successful, you must intraday trade foreign exchange. Well, no, you don't, because foreign exchange just simply does not deliver the gains people think it does. It's immensely entertaining because the market is so deep and so liquid. It's the largest market in the world by far, as you'd expect, being a peer-to-peer professional market. But for retail investors, it in no way delivers the gains people think. We've recently gone through the cycle of, to be financially successful, you must now intraday trade Bitcoin, because Bitcoin's going to take over the world and that'll be it. And I was having lunch with my business partner one afternoon early last year, and we heard a young girl saying to her friend, you must sell your house right now and buy Bitcoin because it's going to $1 million, which is something she'd heard at a seminar. She'd also probably heard that with a $5,000 float, you could make $5,000 a week day trading Bitcoin, but that's a completely different story. There is nothing wrong with taking advantage of herd mentality. Let me give you a personal example. I might think that Tesla is a Ponzi scheme and that it is propped up and buoyed by a group of fanboys who make the Apple fanboys look like amateurs, and that they make a small number of very, very poor cars, and that anyone who thinks that a Tesla is a luxury car has never actually really driven a luxury car. But that doesn't stop me from taking advantage of other people's opinion about what Tesla is. It is that capacity to recognize what the crowd is doing, but not be involved in the crowd. I think that is a key point, and that's the point you made about Warren Buffett. He recognizes what the crowd is doing, but he's not involved in the crowd. So he doesn't share that emotional contagion. His decision-making is not infected by that. And that isolating yourself means that you can see a trend in the market. You can see where share ABC is trending and doing very well. And your checklist, your plan, and your emotional attachment enables you to see that, then take that trade and then leave it, and not be involved in the cheerleading, the emotional contagion or content that comes with all of that, because all of a sudden you have made that transition from amateur to professional. And professionals, by and large, in every field of endeavor, are dispassionate. They're not involved in the emotions of what's going on around them. I think one of the reasons why very good athletes appear to have more time than anybody else is not that they have superhuman reflexes. The threshold limit for a human reflex is fixed, and nobody goes beyond that. But what they have the capacity to do is to analyze information in chunks, but also be detached from the situation so that they're not caught up in what's going around. And this creates the illusion of time. And I think very, very good investors do the same thing. They're just detached. And so they appear to have so much time in the world. And they're not concerned, they're not involved, they don't get emotional, they don't have tantrums, they don't throw things at the screen. And they tend to have what I would call variant perception. And that is, they look at something that is going on and they think, well, what's an alternative way of looking at this? What's a way that that could go wrong? And do other people think that way? And what happens to my investment if that alternative mechanism of thinking becomes the predominant way of thinking? I might think that Tesla is the best thing since sliced bread. And that's all well and good whilst everyone thinks that. But what happens if people all of a sudden wake up one day and go, this firm's run by a psychopath, it's rubbish, and they begin to sell? And you can only do that if you're actually detached, if you're not part of that sort of, you know, mania that crowds tend to get.
You touched on two concepts, which I find interesting. One, I think, is what you're referring to as variant perception is the concept of flow. When athletes get into a flow where the world seemingly slows down and you can't do any wrong. Everything you do is perfect. And it's just, it's not, but it feels like you're just in the zone, as they call it for athletes. And I think you've combined that with another topic that I've heard a bit about, which is kind of second level thinking, right? Is kind of like looking at the situation and not taking it at face value, but looking at the situation and thinking, how are other people going to react to the situation rather than how am I going to react?
This is very much an extension of sort of Daniel Kahneman's thinking fast and slow. Instead of being reflexive, that is just knee-jerk, you become reactive. But to become reactive, you actually need to put a break in how you think. Reflexes occur automatically. They're just something we do. It's like when you accidentally put your hand against a heater and you pull it away immensely quickly. That's a reflexive action. Reactive is where you receive the stimulus, you've seen data, you've seen something, and you stop and pause. And you stop and pause because you seem to have that time. And Thinking Fast and Slow is a book that I think every investor should read. It's strange. Most of the books I recommend on investing have nothing to do with investing. Because once you can look at a chart and go, yes, it's trending up, or look at a balance sheet and go, yes, they're making money, but nothing more to learn. If anything, you head down a rabbit hole of overanalysis. And so Kahneman talks a lot about this differential thinking, this notion of how do we make decisions. Annie Duke, the former professional poker player, who wrote a book called Thinking in Bets, which is very much the same thing, that sort of how do you make decisions logically and based upon the information you have rather than what you think you have or what you want to have, or as opposed to just guessing. You would have seen this in wealth management. A lot of people simply guess, and guessing will only get you so far.
I think you're giving them more credit than they're due. I think guessing would be a step up from what a lot of them do.
You think I'm being a little bit overly optimistic this morning?
Yeah, but as you said, you mentioned the book Thinking in Bets, which is a really good book. I'm going to put that in the show notes. It kind of segues into this topic of, you know, position sizing, right? Because when you're looking at trading, it's not just, is it going up or is it going down? Right. There's many different layers to that if you want to be profitable, because most people think, well, if you're, as long as you're successful 51% of the time, you'll make money. But that's also not true. So yeah. How should people think about investments, position sizing and things like that when they're trading?
Position sizing is one of those sort of, let's call it a rabbit hole, because you can disappear very, very quickly down this quantitative sort of morass that a lot of quantitative traders I've known fall into, and they never get to a point of actually making a decision. Money management, quite simply, we can think of it as let's think of it in simple terms, like the old homily of, well, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. Whilst that sounds sensible, very, very few people actually do it. Position sizing risk management is in many ways a very, very simple thing. You define the amount of risk you're going to take for a given position. once a position falls to that level of risk, you exit. It sounds wonderfully simple. And unfortunately, all of a sudden, emotions start to get involved and people get stuck with this notion of not being able to take losses, which is a psychological problem that all traders have. Risk management is very, very simple. The fundamentals of it are very, very simple to learn. People can, if you look up position sizing on the internet, if you fire up Google, type in position sizing, you'll get chapter and verse on how it works. And again, it's that thing we come back to of a lot of things in investing sound really, really simple, but they're actually very, very difficult to sort of enact because we get in the way. If people can learn to get out of their own way, here I will say modern dealing systems are very good because modern dealing systems enable the placement of automated stop losses that will just fire you out of a position without your knowledge. I had some positions I was thrown out of overnight automatically without knowing. During your trading session during the day there, overnight here, system takes care of it for me. I have to have confidence in the system and let it do its thing. Trading is one of those things that, and investing, the more you leave something alone, the better it seems to be.
It's hard to let positions run when you're making a profit. And it's hard to take a loss when you're losing money. And that's almost the opposite of what you should do, right?
The analogy I would use is that my wife has this annoying habit of when I'm cooking, she'll go and continually open the oven to see how it's going. Just leave it alone. It will do its thing. So shut the oven door. The oven will go ping when it's finished, which is much like trading. If you leave the position alone and you have your stop loss trailing behind, it will go ping when it's finished. And it will do that without your observation, without your interference. And this is a very hard thing, I think, for people to come to terms with, is that all markets do, in very, very simple terms, is they say to you, here is an opportunity. Do you wish to participate, yes or no? And if it's being very generous, it will offer that to you multiple times over multiple timeframes. It will then say to you, okay, this opportunity has ended. Do you wish to leave? Yes or no? And it will do that repeatedly for you. And one of the hard things people have to sort of come to grips with is that the market will go whatever direction it wants to go with or without your participation. So if you're presented with an opportunity of a stock that over the next, say, 12 or 18 months goes up and you have not partaken of that, well, that's your fault. Likewise, if you've partaken of a stock that is now going down, the market's giving you the opportunity to leave. If you stay, that's your decision. It's not the market's decision in any way, shape, or form.
And one thing that kind of comes up too is, we've talked about a lot of topics here, but I know where the, I guess you call it the carrot is for the industry. I know where, you know, the hot buttons are. Like, people want to trade options. They want to trade commodities, futures. They want to, you know, Forex. I mean, all the commercials I see, oh, you can make 1,000% returns doing ABC. And hey, look at my system. Look at this back test that I've never used. And it made 1,000%. Use this. You know, so I know where all the carrots that people lay out there for people to buy into that are usually garbage. But realistically, if somebody wants to get into trading, I mean, there are hundreds of markets around the world. I mean, you could trade coconuts if you wanted. How do you kind of choose the right market and the right asset type to start?
It is simply a matter of, my view is a very simplistic one. And let me use my personal history. When I first started trading or investing a very, very long time ago, the technology did not exist for me to trade anything other than my domestic market. Then derivatives appeared, options and futures, but they were still linked to my domestic market. I can now, I've got my phone in front of me. My phone will enable me to buy and sell herrings in Iceland if I wish. And that's a problem. What initially seems to be a wonderful piece of technology and labor-saving device, as you say, does nothing more than present hot buttons to people. And my advice has always been, start with your own domestic equities market or a segment of it. Start with a time frame that does not prompt you to be constantly looking at the screen. One of the great sort of epiphanies I had many, many, many years ago was I used to trade stocks using daily data. And then in one of those quirks of circumstance, I happened to look at a weekly chart of the same data and went, what the hell have I been doing? Because all of a sudden the noise that was apparent in the daily chart disappeared. And I could see trends that didn't go for, you know, a week, a month, 6 months, but trends that lasted for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and where I could simply take a position and leave it and continue to pyramid into that position and not be afflicted by all the noise and the often random movements that stock prices have. So start locally, start slow. But we come back to that point you made. The industry presents people with hot buttons, and they are so seductive that they are in many, many ways the investing version of junk food ads. They wouldn't do them if they were not so effective. But just like people have to resist junk food ads for their own health, for their own wealth, they have to resist this notion of, you know, you don't need to trade crude oil. It's not compulsory. As Warren Buffett has shown, you can become immensely successful and successful beyond anybody's wildest estimations, simply taking a local and slow approach. Now, it doesn't give you all the jollies you might want, but you have to decide whether you want to be entertained or whether you want to be rich. And that's a question most people don't ask themselves.
I think it's actually a great question people should ask themselves. And I think one of the challenges is people don't recognize the difference. They're not recognizing that it's entertainment, and they're thinking that entertainment equals making money.
If anything encapsulated this problem with trading is that sentence, that entertainment does not equal making money, quite the reverse. As a take-home point, that's a very, very powerful one.
We're going to kind of wrap it up here soon, but I had a question because this also comes up. You know, people hear this a lot from new prospects. Oh, my friend has a system, or my sister's using a system, and, you know, ABC works. Well, it's also another kind of hot button that gets people's interest. So how do you kind of look at systems, like people sell their system? Like, what should people be looking out for?
My view of systems is really quite simple. Black boxes don't work, and they don't work. We come back to that notion of any trading system or approach you use must be idiosyncratic to you. So it must reflect how you see the world. When you look at traders across the world, irrespective of what they do, there are a few key principles. They trade in the prime direction of the market. They employ money management, and they understand how broad trends work. And that's it. There's no magic. And it's very, very difficult, as you say, to draw people away from this notion that there is some magic system. And magic systems have been around forever. And they're in every arena that revolves around money. You see them in casinos. They don't work there because who makes all the money? The casino. They have them on racetracks. They don't work there because who makes all the money? The racetrack does. They don't work in markets. Who makes all the money there? Or people who don't believe in magic and these special systems. You might have bought at the end of a weekend seminar for 15K. Because you need to ask yourself a simple question. If I had the goose that laid the golden egg, would I tell you? There is a reason why algorithmic trading firms are so protective of their intellectual property. It's because their intellectual property works for them and makes them money. If I had some form of algorithmic trading that sat within a box and then I pushed a button and at the end of the week money spewed out, why would I sell it to you for $5,000 at the end of a weekend? You simply wouldn't. It's an illogical concept. The funny thing is that this still has currency, which is quite bizarre. Although here in Australia, our regulators enacted certain legislation many, many years ago to stop the selling of these magic systems. But I do note that it still continues to go on around the world because people are the same the world over. Everybody wants an easy way to do it. It's a little bit like magic weight loss systems. Well, there is no magic to weight loss. It is this long, hard, psychological and physiological process you've got to go through. And it's your unique journey. It has similarities to other people's journey, but it's unique to you. Investing's the same. Your journey has similarities to other people's journey, and it will have commonalities, but it's still your journey. And everybody who is successful in this business has undertaken their own journey.
I love your painting this as magic. I think that is such a perfect description of it. And frankly, I was laughing when you were describing it as, you know, why would anybody sell their system? I mean, Jim Simons was a notoriously private about his successful systems. He made a tremendous amount of money, and all over the street, people were trying to figure it out and they couldn't.
And if you've read his biography, which came out, what, this year? A lot of it is simply how they contain and constrain their intellectual property. And the latter part of it is related to legal action against former employees who they think have taken part of that intellectual property because it is so valuable to them. If you want to think of it in simplistic terms, it's like someone stealing the Colonel's herbs and spices recipe. It's the cornerstone of the business. And so if you had something that was the cornerstone of your business, and that just printed money for you, you wouldn't sell it at an enormously deep discount to some peanut who's attended a weekend seminar with you.
It's a good way to look at it. That should set people right alone. Yeah, no, I love that. Well, as we're kind of wrapping up here, and I really appreciate you coming on the show, Chris, this is exactly what I wanted our listeners to hear is all the psychology that goes into trading and investing. And what are some kind of final thoughts you can leave our listeners with?
When I leave people with final thoughts, again, they tend to be related to the psychology of markets. And it comes back to a sort of a personal breakthrough of mine. And this was brought back to me yesterday when I was talking to a former prop trader. And one of the biggest personal breakthroughs for me was simply this notion of surrender, in that you surrender to the markets. When I sort of began my trading career, you read all the classics. And one of the things you come across is that the Baron Rothschild's quote of buy when there is blood in the street, which I think is a nonsense metaphor for trading. And many, many years ago, I formed a metaphor for trading which revolved around my surfing, in that when you're a surfer, you have no control over the wave, none whatsoever. You can try and position yourself in the right spot at the right time of the day, at the right break, but you still have no control. Even when you're in the wave, you still have no control. You're a passenger. Yes, you can use your skill and finesse to ride it for a little bit long. But at the end of the day, it may simply be that you sat out there all day with your feet dangling in the water, hoping there's no sharks under you, waiting. Or some days might be really good. And some days might end with a really good wave dropping you on your head. But it's still this notion of surrender. And the same is true in trading. You have to surrender to what the market A, offers you, because you can't force it to give you something, but also the fact that you're a passenger. If you're riding a long-term trend, you're a passenger. You can't influence it at all. Your cheerleading, your commentary, your analysis is all irrelevant. And we are all irrelevant to the markets we trade. And many people are sort of thrown a little bit off kilter by that because it's not egocentric. I actually find it enormously empowering because it brings a sense of peace. It brings that calmness that is needed. But it also means that the market's not malevolent. And many people believe that the market is malevolent, that the market knows they exist and is out to get them. No, the market just exists. It's just there. And how you participate, the mechanism of your participation, is completely up to you.
I think that's a great metaphor. You know, and surrendering to the markets. I think that's something I haven't heard before, but I think it's probably more accurate than blood in the streets for sure. One final question, because you seem like you're a very well-read individual. What book or books would you kind of recommend for people who are interested in getting into trading or investing?
There are two that I always recommend to people. And simply because they're very light, they're very compact, they're very easy, and they give people a sense of what is actually required. And they are actually, strange enough, Market Wizards 1 and 2 by Jack Schwager. I did make the mistake once at a lecture to a group of saying that what you should get is both Market Wizards book. And I had someone email me the next day and say, look, I can find Market Wizards 1 and 2, but I can't find one called Both Market Wizards. And I thought, you're perhaps not up to speed on trading. I recommend those simply because it looks at traders of a wide variance of approaches, but you get the sense that there are commonalities between them. It helps convince people that there are many, many ways to solve this problem. You're not forced into a little box. You're not forced to do it a given way. that you might be uncomfortable with. And the third one for people who are a little bit geeky is Benoit Mandelbrot's The Misbehavior of Markets. It's a little bit geeky, but it gives you the sense that markets are just a natural system. They're just a thing that exists. There's nothing special about them. They behave in certain ways, but that behavior can all be brought back to the fact that they will either go up, they will go down, they will go sideways. And what phase they're in is a function of the way people think or how they feel. We come back to the point you made about fear and greed, which also reminds me, again, the notion that if you're going to learn to trade markets, learn to think, which brings us back to Annie Duke's thinking in bets and Daniel Kahneman's thinking fast and slow.
Chris, I really appreciate you coming on the show. This has been wonderful for me, certainly. Where can people find more about you?
The easiest way to find me is on the internet. You can come to my website, which is tradinggame.com.au. You can find me on Twitter under Trading Game. We're on Facebook under Trading Game, or on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn page is under my own name, Christopher Tate. Any and all of those will find me.
All right. Well, that was a great interview with Chris Tate. I have to say, I really enjoyed that one. Those of you who know me well enough know that I love the psychology of investing. I think it is a rabbit hole that is worth going down and learning more about. Not only do you learn about best practices, but you learn a lot about yourself, your best methodology of trading. So I want to introduce the panel portion of the show now. We have our very own Barbara Friedberg. How are you today, Barb?
Doing great, Kirk. How are you?
I'm doing great. Doing great. And we also have our very own Megan Gorman. How are you doing, Megan?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Kirk?
I'm doing great. Great. Well, glad to have you guys both on the show. I mean, this was a great interview. I enjoyed it. Barb, what were your takeaways from the interview?
There was a lot. If I could sum up, the main things that I liked that he said were that you need to know yourself and understand your own kind of style and investing style. And there's no magic formula to wealth and riches. Those, I think, are a good foundation to get you started on the next step of figuring out what type of investor do you want to be. And he didn't really pump that everyone has to be a trader, which I really liked, since I am a long-term investor and more of a buy and hold or tactical investor.
That's a great point. I mean, one of the reasons we brought on Chris is really to get people to think outside the box, not to promote a certain type of investing or trading, but really rather for people to kind of take a step back and think about what's the most appropriate thing for them. Megan, what about you? What are some of your takeaways?
I love the idea of talking about the psychology of money. And I think Barb's right. It's about knowing yourself. When you're looking to invest in the market, you really actually have to do some soul searching on what is the experience going to be about, where I see people make mistakes in this area. One of the biggest mistakes I see is that people have a very unrealistic expectation of return. And Kirk, I know you manage money as well. And it's always sort of alarming when you have someone sitting in front of you and they want you to invest for them, and their expectations are 10 or 20% annually. You know, with this whole idea of the psychology of money and really knowing yourself, you also have to know what's realistic. And, you know, for most investors, what they should be thinking about is, I need to achieve a rate of return that will allow my money to grow and keep up with inflation and allow me to achieve my financial goals. And it seems sort of boring, but the truth is, people make mistakes in investing when they're looking for excitement. And most people really need to pull back their expectations and realize that return range between 5 and 7% annualized is actually doing really well in the marketplace. And that if you have that reasonable expectation, you will not be disappointed over the long term.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Megan. And I want to bring this up because you deal with a certain segment of the market, which all of us as human beings are kind of baited into this, you know, using investment as entertainment. But when you're dealing with the high net worth crowd, you know, some of them feel like they need that. So how do you kind of talk with people about that? I would imagine it's probably hard to, you know, to have those conversations, say, no, sorry, you can't have fun with your money. So like, how do you have those conversations?
I think it's really important to have a mandate for your portfolio, to have what we would call an investment policy statement. And I have one with every client. I review it every year with them. And I'm always adding to it to add depth into the things that they say. What we really try to get them focused on is what are their goals and what they're trying to achieve. I think the thing is, for some of the clients that I work with, because they are in the high net worth space, they get access to more opportunities. But just because you get access to more doesn't make it better. And that's one of the things that we really focus on with them, is that, look, at the end of the day, being in an S&P 500 fund probably will beat most large cap options out there for you. But it's finding those small slivers of interesting things that they can do or to think about investing wise that can make them really enjoy certain aspects of their portfolio. When you ask me that question, interestingly though, I have a client who said has this as his motto, and we have it written in his investment policy statement. And I love this motto because I think it really truly helps us define the portfolio. His motto is, more is the enemy of enough. I always think that that's so important when you're looking at a portfolio, because we always think that the grass is greener at some other firm or some other portfolio or some other investor. But the truth is, we just have to make sure that our portfolio is set up to make us feel that we have enough.
I think that's excellent advice. You know, one thing you just said also about, you know, the wealthy have access to more and more is not equal to better. I think it's important because most investors out there are baited by this idea that having access to things like hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, you know, all these vehicles that the wealthy have access to, they think that somehow that's going to be better for them. And one thing that I found really interesting is, you know, if you have some of the best hedge fund managers in the world, they're really hard to get access to unless you have $100 million to put with them. You know, numbers that are out of the reach of most, you know, reasonable people. What I find interesting is that Wall Street has found ways to give people access to those same funds, but then they're diluted with fees. So you've got like, you know, 3, 4, 5 layers of fees in there. So instead of getting their whatever expected 15% returns, they're only getting 5 because everyone's taking a slice. It's that desire to have access to things that they feel are, this is how the wealthy invest. And, you know, realistically, as you said, Megan, like sometimes investing in the S&P is enough. If you're going to invest in something different, invest because it's better, not because you're trying to attain what, you know, high net worth people are trying to attain. I think it's an excellent comment. And I think it's something that people should really think about, is that don't overcomplicate it. Simple is better. You don't have to get too crazy about things just because you can. So Barb, what are your thoughts when it comes to some mistakes that either you or you've seen investors make from a psychological perspective?
One of the biggest mistakes is being impatient. We're talking about, we're kind of leaning on midterm investors who've built up some capital and are then have some money to work with. I want to focus on new investors for a moment and the mistakes that they might need to avoid, which is when you're first starting out investing, you may not have a lot of money. You may have, you know, I don't know, $50 a month, $100 a month. And you want to get in and start building your capital and your investing. So you start out with an app, M1 Finance, Robinhood, whatever, and you start investing. In general, it's a good idea to start with a very simple index fund investing approach that has been proven to outperform most other strategies over time. So you want to start out investing in the S&P 500, maybe put a little bit in a diversified bond index fund. But then the mistake that I see so many investors, new investors make is, well, they check their progress every month or every week or every day. And if you can see a graph of how compound returns work, because that's in essence what you're trying to do. You're trying to deploy money into the capital markets and have that money make you money by growing in capital gains and by reinvesting the dividends from those firms. In the beginning, your growth is slow, but over time, over the years, your growth compounds at an amazing rate. So the point is, invest for the long term. If you want to play, if you want to trade, if you want to do something cute for fun, take a few dollars. But don't think that's going to get you to where your long-term money goals need to be.
That's great advice, Barb. Now, when we get into things like, I know you had mentioned before the show, Barb, things like the difference between investing and trading. Do you want to touch on that a little bit? I know that there's usually kind of a misunderstanding when it comes to that.
Yeah, I do. And I want to start out by talking about the shiny object, because we all love the shiny object. Oh, this looks so pretty. I've got a new trading strategy that I can make 20% a year. And like Megan said, that's unreasonable. Or if you just invest in Bitcoin, or if you take this approach, you want to be really aware of those types of come-ons. And the difference between investing and trading is this. Investing is a practice of taking your money and deploying it into other assets that have the likelihood of growing, and you participate in that growth. Most investors succeed quite well by deploying their capital into growing companies that can be found on US and global stock markets. You can invest in these through index funds, like I explained in my last comment. Trading is a whole different game. Trading means you are buying and selling short term. So you're looking at a stock that, we'll use stocks as an example. Like Chris said, you can trade any type of asset, but you're looking at a stock that has some momentum. And momentum means that it keeps going up in price. And you think, hey, I'm going to jump on this train that's going up. And I'm going to hop off when the momentum switches or when I think it's going to switch. So you might buy, and there are day traders, there are weekly traders, there are monthly traders. But the idea is you're looking to capture short-term movements in the market. Well, that sounds great, doesn't it? Except that it is exceedingly difficult. And typically, short-term traders underperform long-term steady investors. But if you're compelled to trade, just put a small amount of your money in that and look at that as fun money. But deploy your other capital that you really need for long-term goals, like college education for your kids or like investing for retirement, into more stable buy and hold or longer term investment approaches.
One thing I would actually mention, Barb, is that I think what a lot of people think about when they think of trading, and I think one of the challenges, as you pointed out, is people don't see the difference between investing and trading. But the thing about trading, it's more of an active process, whereas investing is a little bit more passive. I'm not saying it has to be completely passive, but you know, long-term investing is a lot more passive, whereas trading, it's people who do this, if you want to do it well, it's pretty much a full-time job. It doesn't have to be, but it requires a lot of your mental energy. It's not something, anytime you see an ad where it's like, oh, you could make millions day trading and it only takes an hour a week. Well, that's not true. I don't know any traders who are successful who do that. But I think at the end of the day, if you're going to get into trading, just understand what you're getting into. It's not good or bad. There are plenty of successful people who are traders and they make good money, but it requires a different skill set than investing. And I think that's really what people need to realize is the skill sets are different. The requirements are different. You need to understand your investor psychology. If you really need that rush, which I think a lot of these kind of assets, people get a rush from trading. It might be fun, as Barb says, maybe take a little money and play with it, some play money. But for your real wealth, I don't know any, I mean, we can ask Megan here, but I don't know any high net worth people who day trade with all of their wealth. They put it all on the line and make these day-to-day decisions. I don't know anybody who does that. Anybody I know who does it, they still have a diversified approach, so they don't have all their eggs in one basket. What are your kind of thoughts, Megan? What have you seen?
I'm actually thinking, I have one client who manages his own portfolio, but he has his own strategy and philosophy and does due diligence. So it's not just random trading, although he's pretty active in it. And by the way, that's because he knows himself as an investor. And, you know, it's a little bit of backstory on that. It was somebody that when I first started working with, had been working with big firms for years and never felt satisfied. He always felt he could do better than they could. When we started working together, I said, okay, if you can do it, this is your money. So I think that that's really important, is to know who you are and be willing to take accountability in knowing who you are as an investor. Most people follow a certain set rule or an asset allocation on how they want to build their portfolio out. You know, I think that what high net worth investors are pretty good at doing is understanding that sometimes simplicity is elegant in portfolio construction. And there's not the need to have 20 different funds or ETFs in each asset class. And I can tell you, as I watch people grow their wealth, when they make that leap from a portfolio construction standpoint, a lot of times when I do get clients and they're just starting to really make these significant assets, one of the first things we often spend a lot of time doing is cleaning up portfolios. Because over the years, they've been, you know, getting advice from different places, doing stuff on their own. And so when we go into the portfolio, we are looking at something where they might own the same holdings again and again and again, but in different formats. And so it's really about being able to winnow everything down and have each asset class sort of speak for itself. And what I mean by that is, when markets are challenging, like they've been this past year, we want to be able to look at the portfolio and understand, is it the asset class or the underlying investment? And if you have 15 holdings in small cap, it's going to be a lot harder to see. But if you have 2 to 3 core holdings in small cap, what we often find is we can start to diagnose it and say, ah, this isn't working because small caps had a hard year. And in particular, value stocks have had a hard year, because we can compare it to the relevant benchmark. When working in the high net worth group, a lot of it is very much portfolio construction, an institutional way to invest, and following process, which, going to Barb's point, is sort of boring and you have to be patient, but it's what works.
Yeah, that's great advice, Megan. And just for reference, value stocks have had a bad 12 years.
Exactly.
Thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, just saying.
I like value, but it's been hard. I'm sorry, but you know, to interrupt.
The benefit of asset allocation is you're never going to be 100% in the best performing asset class, but you're also never going to be in the 100% in the worst performing asset class. So in general, you're going to have a smoother ride with probably an overall better return than if you're trying to sector pick the winners and the losers.
That's great advice, Barb. And I think that's really kind of a hat tip to diversification, and why it's important is none of us know the future. I know Wall Street likes to bait everybody by saying, here's what's going to happen. And people always ask what's going to happen, but we don't know the future. And that's why diversification works. We're going to, in the interest of time, we're going to wrap it up here. Barb, last words from you, and where can people find more about you?
Well, Kirk, investing is a long game. And if you're interested in building wealth through investing, it's really a wonderful way to grow your money for the long term. But what you want to do is you want to start out, understand the markets, educate yourself a little bit, choose an approach, I have hammered in on this podcast enough for you all to know that I like a passive index fund investing approach. And the research has proven that that has done very, very well and outperformed most active strategies over the years. So my name is Barbara Friedberg. You can find me at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance or at RoboAdvisor Pros. See you next time. Bye.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. And Megan, final thoughts from you.
It's the same core approaches, which is know yourself, find someone who's willing to challenge you on your philosophy and expectations of a portfolio, and understand that at the end of the day, most of this type of investing is quite boring. And, you know, we have been sort of tricked into thinking it's supposed to be as chaotic as we see on TV, because there are TV stations devoted just to investing and they've got to keep us interested in watching. But true investing, you know, you just have to invest and then not look constantly. You know, we were saying before the show, a watch pot never boils. And I think that's the same with your portfolio. So, you know, one of the things I hope we get to do at some point, Kirk and Barbara, is I'd love to in January talk about how our portfolios did this past year, because it's been a challenging market to navigate. And I think that if we all look at it, most of us probably didn't change much during the volatility. And that's because, again, sometimes the best investing is just letting it run its course and following your asset allocation. So I'm Megan Gorman, and you can find me at thewealthintersection.com. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, Megan. And I would actually like to reiterate one of the points that Megan said, because I think it's really important. We talk about this on the show all the time, which is you really have to know your investor psychology. You have to know what works for you. And Wall Street has been created to, as kind of like a mimicking a casino. Lots of bells and whistles and sounds. And, you know, you look at your screen and things are blinking and red and, you know, green, and this is up, this is down. And it psychologically tricks you into getting sucked into the game. And you look at people like Warren Buffett, who removed himself from the game way out in Omaha in no man's land when it comes to investing, or at least it was when he went there. And he removed himself from that so he could think, so he could have his own thoughts and not be persuaded by everything else that's going on. And I think that's really important for people to understand. You need to come to your own conclusions. You need to be aware of all the bait being thrown around out there of you need to be doing this, you need to be doing that, or your neighbor telling you, oh, I made 20% yesterday on this stock. And then you feel like, oh, I didn't make 20%. What's wrong with me? I got to start following my neighbor's advice. You know, and we see this a lot where people just get baited by other people. Anytime your neighbor says, oh, I made this much money, how much did you make? Think of it this way. When you go to the casino, how many people come back from the casino with, oh yeah, I lost $1,000 today. Oh, poor me. No one ever tells you when they lost. If they lost $1,000, they're going to come back and say, hey, I won $100 on this hand, even though they lost $1,000. It's not always the full truth. I call it kind of half truths. And you don't really know the real story. And frankly, your neighbor might have a different investor psychology than you, so you shouldn't be following it to begin with. So the point is know yourself, know your investor psychology, and invest in what you know. And another point that I'll leave it off with a quote, an Einstein quote, which is everything should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler. So as you're investing, keep it simple, keep it within your own psychology, figure out what you do well and go with that. So that's it for the show this week. Thanks again for joining us on Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name's Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager of Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth. We make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on this show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all the resources, show notes, and archive shows. Last, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.